Welcome, everyone, to episode 373 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we finally have details on the 2020-2021 season. So we will break down all that it means specifically with regard to free agency, which is starting, oh, by the way, next week. Before we get into that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. And we are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Today, we are also recording on Locker Room, where you can listen live to us. So download the Locker Room app. It is right now only on iOS, but hopefully there will be an Android version soon as well. But you can hang out live, ask questions, even come up on stage with us. So check it out. It'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah. You'll have to be worthy, though, like Doris Hemmer.
Right. Exactly. And with that said, is my, I don't have the full description, but something beach turtle, obese, overweight, something, something. Morten Jensen, how's it going?
Yeah, thank you. That's definitely the word I want to get associated with myself with. Not that it's untrue. It's this reminder twice a week that I am morbidly obese. Thank you, Brian. Thank you. I very much appreciate that. I'm doing well outside of being mortally obese, apparently.
That's good.
No, it's been an optimistic few days for obvious reasons. Yeah. And it's been, yeah, I mean, not just in terms of basketball, but also just politically from a worldwide perspective. No, but basketball is coming back sooner rather than later. We've never had this short of a break in between seasons, which I think is that could get intoxicating really quickly to me.
Yeah, well, I feel like usually I have a plan, you know, during the off season to like binge a show that I never end up doing, or like finish a video game that I never end up doing. And then this news comes out last night, I'm like, oh crap, there is a month at most between the draft, free agency, and the start of this season. It makes me realize, once again, I will not be catching up on Breaking Bad. So maybe next summer.
Right. Right. I mean, and look, to just today, I'm playing the new Assassin's Creed game. That just came out, you know, at midnight. So that is brand new. And I'm thinking I have to rush through it.
Yeah.
That's the first time ever.
Yeah, so let's get right into the details, Mort. For those who missed it, this news dropped at about midnight Eastern last night that the NBA and NBPA have agreed to a tentative framework for this upcoming season.
The NBA salary cap is effectively going to stay the same for 2021 for as it did here in this season, 19-20. It's going to stay at 109.14 million. The tax is going to stay flat at 132.627 million, to be completely precise. This is such a huge win for the NBA, given that there was so much uncertainty surrounding the salary cap. Didn't really know where it was going. It could have been slower, or much lower rather. And the fact that they could stay the same is such a huge asset. Are you back, Brian?
I am, yeah, sorry about that.
All good. I'm just telling the people that, you know, what the cap numbers are and how it's such a huge win for the NBA, or actually teams rather, that the fact that they could stay the same, because this allows general managers the chance to actually plan ahead. They wouldn't have to scramble, which is such a huge luxury. I mean, I can hear that you're scrambling the ever-living hell out of your equipment, which is fun, but NBA general managers won't have that problem, which is great, and I think that's probably the biggest thing that we can kind of latch onto going into the next season, right? It's the fact that the NBA won't be in a situation where they would force to lower the cap to like 90 million, see like a huge drop-off in player salaries, because it would have messed up free agency, it would have messed up like long-term planning. The fact that they stayed at the same is just a win overall for the NBA, I think.
For sure, yeah. I mean, there's details about the escrow in particular that if you really care, go read like anything I've written at Forbes for the last 9 months. It's not really going to affect anything. It's basically just their way of balancing the cap to make sure players' share of, you know, basketball-related revenue doesn't get totally out of whack. But, yeah, I think to your point, Mort, prior to the pandemic, I think January 30th was the latest projection of what the cap was going to be before everything went to hell. And it was supposed to be 115 for the cap and 139 for the tax. So, yeah, you know, you're shaving about $6 million off of both because the league lost upward of $1 billion since they had to cancel regular season games, no fans at the bubble. But, you know, honestly, it could have been a lot worse. And then, you know, moving forward, they say each year the cap and tax are going to increase by a minimum of 3% and a maximum of 10% over the prior season. So that at least gives teams some framework with which to work, especially as if they're considering making multi-year offers.
Right.
You know, I think general managers probably would have preferred exact cap figures to be set for the next few years, just to give them, you know, the clear blueprint of, okay, if I sign this guy to a 4-year deal and it increases by 5%, what does that mean in 2021, 2022, 2023, so on.
Yeah.
But at least they have some semblance of, okay, you know, if the cap's going to go up a minimum of 3%, I'm signing a guy with annual raises of 5%. That contract isn't going to get, like, so out of whack relative to the increase in the cap, where it's not like the cap is going to, you know, is at risk of falling or staying flat again. So,
right. So, and just to put it into context, Brian, it's kind of a luxury problem, you know, for NBA general managers. Like, sure, they would have preferred those numbers, but I'm pretty sure the entire world would have preferred to not have gone into a 9-month lockdown. So this, by all means, is a win in that regard. I understand what you're saying, but, like, I think even NBA teams and even the most cynical general manager in the game, whoever that might be, has to look at that number right now and go, you know what? That's a lot better than what I feared.
Yeah, for sure. The other thing of note from this announcement is that teams' luxury tax payments will be reduced in proportion to any BRI decreases. So to put that in actual English, you know, that the league projects a certain amount of BRI basketball-related income every season. It was probably going to be north of $9 billion had the pandemic not happened. You know, for months now, Woj has been reporting, hey, no fans in the stands. That means 40% of the league's revenue is gone. If we have the entire 2020-21 season without any fans in the stadiums, that wipes out probably north of $4 billion. I don't think we're going to have that. I mean, the NBA is already talking about having some suites open to fans. Like, I think we probably have limited attendance, if not, you know, rather than no attendance. And who knows the state of the world next May, June, July? Like, maybe a vaccine is widespread by then, and maybe you can safely have 10,000, 15,000 fans in the stadium. So I don't think they're going to lose the $4 billion, but they are going to lose some money relative to what they expected. So for the teams in tax territory, their tax payments will also decrease accordingly. So, like, if, correct, you know, it decreases by, let's just say, 30%, and a team like the Warriors were supposed to pay $60 million in tax, well, instead their tax payment is going to fall by 30%. They'll end up only paying $42 million in tax. They save $18 million. Right. So, you know, it's still a lot of money that these teams in tax territory are going to be paying, but it's not necessarily as much as they would have feared.
Right. Welcome to math.
I know. Yeah. If you got into journalism, sports journalism, because you thought there weren't going to be numbers involved, the joke was on you. So Mort, let's go through, like, the winners of this announcement at first. You know, the team, I wrote about him for Forbes today. We've talked about him in past episodes, but the team that really jumps to mind for me is the Atlanta Hawks.
Of course it is. I mean, it's a team that had tremendous amounts of cap space, and now that cap space is still going to be somewhat optimized. Like, yes, the salary cap ended up $6 million below what was projected around a year ago, but I mean, had it gone down to 90, I mean, that would have been a very difficult season for Atlanta, who came in expecting a significant load of cap space, which they still have. Mm-hmm. So, yes, in general, I want to say the teams that have significant amount of cap space are really coming out as winners in this.
Yeah. According to our friend of the podcast, Keith Smith, he went through the projected amounts of cap space for every team this morning. Atlanta is number one on the list with 44.3 million. Knicks have 42.4. Detroit is at 30 flat. Miami could get to 21.9 if it renounced Goran Dragic and Jay Crowder, but I don't know that that's going to happen. Right. Charlotte's at 19.4. Phoenix is at 17.8. But again, that assumes they renounce Dario Saric and Aaron Baines. So really, you're looking at Atlanta, New York, Detroit, Charlotte are the only four teams guaranteed to have cap space this offseason. And, you know, the Knicks, Pistons, and Hornets are all... Well, Knicks and Pistons are very much in the very beginning stages of a rebuild. The Hornets are just kind of floating in mediocrity. I mean, they're not, you know, they're in the East, so like any team could be a playoff contender, but I don't think anyone looks at the Hornets roster right now as like, yeah, man, this team is just one piece away from really being a top four threat in the East. Like, Right. Okay, sure, they could squeak into the 7 or 8, whatever. But Atlanta, you know, you have Trae Young, who already second year All-Star. You have a bunch of young, promising pieces. John Collins, Kevin Herter, DeAndre Hunter.
DeAndre Hunter.
Cam Reddish, yeah, exactly. So, like, they've got a bunch of young pieces that should be interesting and can continue growing together. They got Clint Capella at the trade deadline. They have Dedmon.
The sixth. Dwayne Dedmon, and yeah. They also have the sixth overall pick.
Yeah, so they have... I mean, like, they could, even if they stood still this offseason, didn't do anything except for making that pick, I think you could still reasonably make a case that they would be in the playoff hunt next year. Right. But what I laid out at Forbes is that, you know, this might be their best time to strike. Because not only do they have the most cap space in the league, but because so few teams have cap space other than them, and because those teams are very bad, you know, they aren't going to face a ton of competition for free agents. Now, there aren't that many good free agents out there.
I was about to say, yeah, they're not going to be celebrating when they sign DeMar DeRozan.
Right. So, I mean, that is the complication. And Travis Schlenk, their general manager, has talked about it. You know, he said, like, look, we have this cap space, but I don't feel pressure to spend it all, because I think that's when teams get in trouble, is when, you know, they're saying, I've got 44 million cap space, I got to blow it all, and then all of a sudden you're giving Hassan Whiteside right. a max contract. Like, I don't expect that out of the Hawks, but, you know, they have to be looking at the landscape moving forward, knowing, okay, John Collins is up for an extension this offseason. If not, he's a restricted free agent next summer. I'm hoping next offseason is this in the summer. I'm going to make that assumption. Trae Young up for an extension next offseason. If not, he's going to be a free agent in 2022. He's almost certain to get a max extension next summer. I don't think there's much of a question there. So Realistically, I mean, depending on what happens with Collins, if they re-sign him, they re-sign Trae Young, all of a sudden this wealth of cap space that they have now is probably gone in 2 years.
Exactly. And that is why you need to strike when you have a lot of players on rookie contracts.
Right. And, you know, next offseason, it's going to be a lot more loaded in terms of free agency, or it's projected to be. We'll see what happens with Giannis and Kawhi, LeBron, Paul George, all those guys. You know, if Giannis signs a Supermax, none of those guys opt out. Suddenly it's a little bit less appealing than we thought it would be. But There's also going to be a lot more teams that have been eyeing that 2021 free agent class that have cap space and have been planning ahead for that summer. So Atlanta is going to be facing a lot more competition for free agents next summer in general, even if they aren't going after the Giannises of the world.
Agreed.
So, I mean, I think, you know, I'm not saying the Hawks are going to go like max out Fred VanVleet or anything like that. We've talked about Davis Bertans before as a possible target for them, especially if they want to move on from John Collins. I think that makes a lot of sense. Jeremy Grant could as well.
Yeah.
But I think the thing that really works in their favor is, okay, you know, so many teams are going to be limited to some version of the mid-level exception, whether non-taxpayer is 9.3-ish million, taxpayer is 5.7. Atlanta can just be sitting out here and say, like, all right, we'll offer you $12 million starting salary. Like, just bump it up a little bit more than that MLE and see if you can get a, you know, get a guy to bite, even if it's on a 1 or 2 year deal. Like, just lock in some cheap talent or some guys that, you know, prior to the pandemic, we would have thought would be $20 million players. Now they're $12 million players.
Right. No, I think it's a sound strategy. I mean, when you have all the money available and no one else does, that puts you in a position of power. So, yes, they have to utilize that position very, very well. And I think they will. I think they'll find a way to make it work on their behalf some way, somehow. I mean, we also know that they are aggressively shopping that sixth pick because Trae Young is apparently, despite only having finished his second season, is very fed up with losing.
Mm-hmm.
And has basically just said, told the team, you know, you need to make us a winner. Like, mm-hmm. come on, go get guys. He is not resting on his laurels whatsoever. He's, what, 21 years old? And he is demanding change in that organization when it comes to talent acquisition. So I have a feeling that it'll come through a trade, and then they'll use their cap space to absorb those contracts, whoever they get. And then if there's something left in what capacity, you know, then they'll go out and splash on with the remaining money or sign someone with the MLE.
Yeah. And the thing working for them, you know, as you said, the cap space can help them with an unbalanced trade. Normally, if two teams above the cap are trading, you have to send out, you know, a certain amount of salary if you're taking back, you know, if you're taking back $20 million, you can't send back like $5 million. There are different rules based on how much you're sending out, but you know it has to be roughly equivalent or like
125% plus 100,000, right?
Wasn't that the old rule? If you're sending out at least like $19 million, that's the deal. If you're sending out between like 6.5 and 19, it's that amount of salary plus $5 million. But again, like somewhere in the ballpark. But Atlanta, like I mentioned, Drew Holiday in my piece at Forbes. Like if the Pelicans really want to move on from Drew Holiday, the Hawks don't have to send back $27 million in salary. They could send, you know, say take number six and Hunter or Cam Reddish or whoever, like John Collins, we don't care. But like we don't have to send back 20+ million. We could just send back those two pieces and then whatever, you know, whatever else the Pelicans would want to sweeten that deal. So that gives them flexibility as well on the trade market. And then, you know, we've mentioned this as a strategy for bad teams for how long, like years now, is if you have cap space, accept salary dumps. If teams are willing to package bad contracts with picks or young players, and you're willing to take those contracts on, like if you're looking, you know, if you're Atlanta and you're saying, we got $44 million, we don't really want to spend $25 million on Hassan Whiteside this summer, we'll take a Nicholas Batum if you give us a PJ Washington attached or a Mikal Bridges attached. Like,
right, because Miles then Bridges. That becomes their free agent acquisition in a way.
Right. So I think the Hawks have more flexibility than any other team in the league this offseason because they should be attractive to free agents, but they also have all of these trade options and they have that number six pick that they're dangling. But I mean, I think the salary dump thing also really applies to Charlotte, Detroit, New York as well. Like all of those teams, that's how they should be looking to spend that cap space.
Detroit will be looking at it that way. Detroit are apparently very aggressive in doing just that.
Mm. Interesting.
Which, okay. Yeah, which again, it makes sense. It's such a you know non-starter if you don't do it. Like it has to be the way that you think. If you know that you have, you know, a handful of years in front of you where talent acquisition is going to be a step-by-step process, yes, this is a way where you can accelerate it if you have a lot of money available. Like, I am pretty sure that right now they would be very willing to give up Blake Griffin for an even longer deal and then squeeze out an additional asset because of it. by basically saying, hey, you know what? You guys get a Blake Griffin who expires in 2021. We'll take on, you know, a contract that expires in 2022, for example, and all it's going to cost you is a young prospect or an unprotected first rounder or whatever. And that indirectly becomes, you know, a acquisition to or a building block for the future. And that's the same with Atlanta as well. Like, I think it's an interesting way of going about it, because one thing is, yes, you could spend that money, but if you go that route of salary dumping for other teams, like you're the dump, essentially, and you actually make that extraction of a young player or a draft pick, yeah, that, like I said, that's your free agent acquisition. Like, that's the guy you're going to get. Like, you're not going to walk away empty-handed. You're not going to just accept getting on a bad contract on your books and that's it. No, you're getting something of substance for that salary acquisition.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So let's go to the teams that are hurt by this, the flattened cap, flattened tax. And I think we have to start with the tax-paying teams.
Of course.
I think there was some hope that even if they kept the cap flat at $109 million, which has been the expectation for months now, you know, there was hope that they would at least bump the tax up to the projected $139 million, just because teams have been, you know, building with these increased numbers in mind. Like, teams have been signing players to contract, multi-year contracts, figuring, okay, the cap's going to go up every year. It's no big deal. It'll increase proportionally. We're not going to get hit with an enormous tax bill. And then the cap doesn't go up, and all of a sudden, you know, you have teams that are already 15, 20 million over the luxury tax threshold. And it, you know, I think we said this an episode or two ago, it gets really, really expensive really quickly once you hit that 15 to 20 million over. You know, the penalty per dollar keeps going up and up and up.
Yeah.
And it's just prohibitively expensive to start spending once you get that high. So I'm looking at teams like the Golden State Warriors, the Philadelphia 76ers, the Boston Celtics, the Brooklyn Nets. Even though there is this whole, like, you know, the tax penalty will decrease with the BRI, I'm wondering if this, that'll help for sure, but I still don't know if that's going to be enough to make these teams that are already 15, 20 million over, if that's going to make them willing to spend. You know, the Warriors, I think, are the perfect example, right? Like, they have this, the Andre Iguodala trade exception. I think it's 17.2 million, something like that.
Yeah, correct.
Are they willing to use that? Are they willing to use their taxpayer mid-level? You know, it does.
So I have thoughts on that, actually. I have strong thoughts on this.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. No, so basically, this is the biggest question that's been floating around Warriors Twitter and the Warriors fan base, of course. You know, will we use that $17.2 million? And look, you have a dynasty on your hands. Yes, you absolutely should use that, because, look, you can basically churn out money down the line if you win another championship as a direct result of a acquisition of that sort. Like, let's say it's a, Spencer Dinwiddie. He fits, right, financially? I think he's at 16. Yeah. So theoretically, let's say, you know, you offer some sort of asset attached to that TPE. You get Spencer Dinwiddie. And Spencer is a perfect fit. The Warriors, you know, are healthy. And they win the championship once again. The extra money that they'll get, you know, down the line as being this, this dynasty of a franchise, that's just going to come back in a good way. And the reason I mention that is look at the Chicago Bulls, right? They won the rings with Mike, and then they led the league, you know, years after in they were called the financial champions. Like, they had the highest earnings of any team, like, 8 years in a row. Like, they were absolutely insanely profitable. And that was solely off the backs of that, you know, one dynasty. Because their teams otherwise sucked. So for the Warriors, if this is an investment where you go, okay, it's $17.2 million in the initial investment and then comes the luxury tax, sure, that's a ton of money. But look at what it gives you down the road. It could give you everything. And also, I'm not really that inclined to sit back and go, oh no, that poor billionaire's checkbook.
Right. I mean, that is the fundamental point that we should always hammer home when we're talking about taxpaying teams. It's not your money, unless you're one of the 30 NBA owners listening to this podcast, in which case... it is your money, and you should still spend it because
that's more... Hi, Tillman. how are you doing, sweetie? Are you okay? I've heard bad news about your entire business. Just prayers up, boy. It's okay.
You know, as Mort says, you can reap the financial benefits for years to come just based on merchandise. I guess, you know, there are two questions to bounce off of that. One, you're probably not going to have 20,000 fans in attendance next year. I think you could still have some fans, but I don't think we're having full stadiums at any point next season. So,
right.
You know, does that decline in ticket sales, revenue, game day, purchases of merchandise, yes. Does that factor into the equation at all?
Of course it does, but I'm thinking long term. Like, yeah. Especially for the Warriors. I'm not applying that logic that I do with the Warriors to the Sixers or the Celtics, I think. Well, you know, first and foremost, they don't have the TPE of $17 million, so they're not even in that situation. But also, I just don't think the Sixers are going to win a championship next year. I think they were at least a couple years away from that. They need to implement a new coach, a new strategy at the top of the organization. You know, they're probably going to move a couple pieces around. I just don't think they are in it next year, necessarily. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to take a couple years. So in that sense, you know, why would you try to add on the tax bill? That I get. But the Warriors could just be that one exception to the rule because they are just so primed. I mean, if they win another ring, then they'll have, you know, the whole 2021 championship merchandise that comes out as well. Like jerseys, jackets, even denim pants, right? I mean, everything. And that just has longevity. That's a lot. And you can have, down the line, you can have, oh, Remembrance Night for 2021 when they won the championship. Oh, we just had, you know, the most crowds we've had all year long because our team sucks. It's the year 2034 and we are, you know, 1-35. But we have Remembrance Night. Steph Curry is going to come out to the floor and talk. And we have just loaded up the arena. And, you know, it's going to pay back eventually. Down the line, winning a championship is going to be profitable for any franchise.
Yeah. So here's the other thing, when it comes to the Warriors. And I'm double-checking this math quickly, but...
Oh, it's the rookie contract?
Well, just from what I'm seeing, they already have almost $149 million on their books. So they're already, correct, you know, more than $16 million over the tax line. And
yes,
just there, if it was only $16 million over, the non-repeater tax penalty alone is $32
million. Yeah.
Then if you add in the number two pick, if they do not trade it, that's another $7.3 million. So then we get up to 23.2 over the tax. Now you're looking at a tax penalty of $57 million. Then you add in the TPE. Then we're looking, you know, then possibly if they're not shedding salary elsewhere, which I don't think would be the case, but if they were $40 million over the tax line, they'd be looking at a tax penalty of $160 million.
I mean, yeah. That's a lot of cheddar, but look at how much they've earned over the past many years because of their success. They just went out and got a new stadium.
Yeah.
I mean, that wouldn't have happened if they hadn't been successful. I get it. And once again, I have to reiterate, it's a billionaire sitting at the helm.
Right.
So yeah, I understand 160 million, lot of money, lot of cheddar, but it's a billionaire. And if there's a franchise in the NBA that I feel very certain about will be profitable long term, it's the Golden State Warriors.
That is fair. Yeah, and I mean, you still do have, you know, it's $160 million, but again, you're hypothetically, let's say the cap falls or the BRI falls by 30%, shave 30% off of that, then it's down to $112 million. So you are knocking off almost $50 million right there.
Boom, so that's a full MLE contract right off the books.
Yeah, so like, I think having the tax penalty decline along with however much the BRI declines, it should make these teams, even in tax territory, hypothetically, it should make them more willing to spend their TMLEs at least.
Yeah, I think so too.
And I think that will, you know, even the playing field a bit for these teams. Like, I was very skeptical that the Sixers in particular, I mean, they've been spending out the wazoo this offseason on their coaching staff and new front office, which I think is commendable, especially in this pandemic. But I was, you know, I was skeptical that they would keep the number 21 pick. I was skeptical that they'd spend the TMLE. Now I think they might, if only because there, you know, there is this decline tied in with the BRI drop. But it is just a question hovering over these tax teams right now. And not only the tax teams, but, you know, teams right on that threshold, like the Milwaukee Bucks, if they spend, you know, I haven't done the full math yet, but like if they spent the full MLE, would that put them in tax territory? Does that mean they only have the TMLE instead? Are they willing to go into tax territory? The answer better be yes, if you want to keep Giannis, but, you know, they're right on the threshold. Houston Rockets right now looks like they are $1 million under the tax threshold right now. So
they're one ice cream cone away from being tax believers. Yeah.
So Godspeed to their new front office, try to figure out how to appease Tillman. Pacers are not far away from the tax. So, like, are teams willing to use their full non-tax MLE if it pushes them into tax territory? I don't know the answer to that question, particularly, like, you know, for a small market like Indiana, I would guess not.
Yeah. And also because they're not championship contenders, right? I mean,
right.
There is the sports element of it as well. To, you know, how far can we go? How do we look financially if we, you know, don't even make the playoffs, or if we make the playoffs but we are projected to get bounced in five in the first round? You know, it's that changes how much money you're willing to dedicate to a team, obviously. If the Pacers, you know, had great returns on Victor Oladipo, just like him, you know, getting healthy and like they watched him in workouts and they were like, oh, he's back to normal, he might even be better, hell, we might actually have a legitimate franchise guy on our hands. Mm-hmm. You know, that could change that picture, you know, immediately. In the NBA, I feel this sentence is always true. It's the margins that count, right? Because if everyone hits on the margins and you grow substantially better as a direct result of that, then teams more than likely are willing to spend because everything is coming up Milhouse for them.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, you're never getting rid of that sentence.
One other thing I'd like to hit on is that, you know, again, only 4 to 6 teams, depending on what Phoenix and Miami do, are projected to have meaningful cap space this offseason. So if you're a free agent, like a Fred VanVleet, Danilo Gallinari, Davis Bertans, you know, guys who should have a market, like guys who are very good, could help any team, like deserve more than the MLE, right now it looks like you're options are A, re-sign with your current team, B, you could join a whole host of contenders, but probably only for the MLE,
right?
Or C, I mean, I'm wondering if we see a lot more sign-and-trades than usual. We saw it last summer. I think there were 12 in total, and I just have to think that with so many teams so limited in terms of their cap space, that's how they're going to try to make a free agent splash, sign-and-trades.
Yeah. No, I think so too. The signing trade came back last year, and I think it's a little bit here to stay, because why not use all the opportunities that you have in front of yourself to improve your roster? The thing is, though, for the teams high up in the tax territory, that becomes a question, because then they can't take on more money in a signing trade, because then they would be hard capped. And if you're hard capped, you have no flexibility whatsoever. So you're probably looking at the teams that are significantly below the tax line, but still have some variations of contracts that are flexible in terms of getting moved, having trade value, and having the ability to take something back in a trade long term. So,
yeah,
you know, one team that comes to mind for Fred VanVleet, or you know, or that's the Lakers. The Lakers would be a fantastic destination for him. The question is, do they have the necessary elements or trade assets to send out in a sign and trade where that is going to make sense for both parties? You know, then it becomes a value question. But yes, I totally agree with you that there are certainly teams out there that could use this. This chance of improving the roster by using the sign trade, the Lakers being chief among them, maybe even the Clippers. The Clippers always seem to be a little bit more, you know, financially creative, I think, when it comes to these matters. Portland, I think, could be another team that could be sneak under the radar a little bit. So, yeah, I mean, definitely a factor.
A Fred VanVleet, KCP, double sign and trade, anyone?
Ew. Danny Green as a seller for back to Toronto.
Yeah.
Oh, Lakers fans would have a field day. Wow.
They would be thrilled. They hate Danny Green.
Yeah, they really do. I missed 1-3.
I know. No, I think you're right to name those teams. I mean, I wonder, Dallas is another one that, especially they have the, you know, Tim Hardaway Jr. If he picks up that player option,
that's don't go into Dallas. They are saving for 2021.
No,
I refuse to entertain any alternatives.
That's fair.
I want to speak this into existence. Okay, this needs to happen. I didn't even know that. I got a DM for a Dallas Mavericks fan who told me so. When you started talking about the whole Giannis thing and you just kind of went with it and ran with it for like a couple months, you know, we actually started like talking amongst ourselves a little bit more.
So
apparently I got Dallas fans riled up on this idea. So I have a feeling that if Giannis signs the Supermax this season, I'm going to get a bunch of angry DMs.
All right, well, now I'm rooting for that to happen.
You gave us hope, Morton.
All right, I'll remove Dallas from the equation for it. I mean, that is, I was about to say the Heat too, but that's also a consideration for them that, you know, teams are going to have to balance going after, you know, do we fortify our rosters now, especially a team like the Heat where, you know, they're in the NBA Finals, they're two games away from a title. Jimmy Butler's not getting any younger, but like they have made no secret that they want to go after Giannis, want to go big game hunting this next offseason. I mean, I think we've discussed the Heat in the past, but like they have a lot of dominoes that they have to set up in the exact right way.
Yeah.
Because if they do want to go after Giannis or someone else in 2021, they can't sign Bam to an extension this summer. He is eligible for one. This offseason. He is eligible for one, but you know, his extension would kick in right away next offseason. So they have to, like, they can agree, hey, we're going to give you a 5-year max next offseason. Right. You just have to be willing to sit there and not listen to any offers. Like, no matter what happens, we're giving you that deal. I'm sure they're going to communicate that with his agent. I don't foresee any issues there, but, you know, that's the problem if they want to re-sign Goran Dragic, Jay Crowder to more than a 1-year deal, if they wanted to go after a Danilo Gallinari, I'm sure they're going to go at whoever they go after. They're going to say, okay, we'll give you a 2-year deal. Second year is either a team option or it's fully non-guaranteed. And the non-guarantee extends for the first few days after free agency. Cause like, we're not risking it. Mm. We're just not, we know we're close and we're willing to do what we have to compete this year, but we also know, you know, we might be in the market for the 2-time reigning MVP next summer, and we aren't going to screw that up.
Right. So you just brought up Danilo Gallinari, and I think there's something interesting there because the Oklahoma City Thunder are open to actually taking on bad contracts and basically just being a dumping ground for bad contracts. Now, if you are the Thunder and you can offer in a trade, of course, with his blessing and something that he wants it to do, let's say that you're in a conversation with a team and you go, you know what, we'll take your very awful long-term contract and instead we'll give you Danilo Gallinari re-signed in a sign-and-trade. So not only do you just take a bad contract back, you actually give the opposing team a very, very valuable player, what kind of haul could they get for that? Because you and I have talked about, like, when bad teams want to maximize their assets that they get back in the salary dump. Like, if they actually send something out that is fairly attractive, i.e. Danilo in this case, you know, they should theoretically have optimized what they can get in return as compensation. I mean, I would argue that the Thunder are looking, you know, they're already loaded with draft picks, so they already look great. But I would argue that if they could flip Gallinari for a bad contract and maybe even multiple assets as compensation, like then we'd be looking at the Thunder as probably the most clear-cut, bright future team in the league, no?
The first thing that came to mind was Wiggins in number two.
Right?
Because, I mean, the problem is it would leave the Warriors really, really thin on the wing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, maybe they would ask for, OKC has 25 this year, maybe they would ask for that too and just draft best wing available at that point. But I still don't, I mean, if you're the Warriors, you're contending for a title right away. I don't know that you're trusting a rookie wing 25 pick with, you know, starting on. So they'd probably have, maybe that's what they use the traded player exception for. Maybe they use their TMLE on that. But
oh, and they can use their CPE on a sign trade. Like, again, bringing up Keith Smith, who actually laid that out for us in one of our DM groups. That's pretty interesting. That opens a couple doors as well.
Yeah. So, I love the idea. I mean, Gallo, I think, is probably the most, to me, he's the most interesting free agent on the market. Just because he's like very clearly could be a big difference maker in the title picture, but like, you know, he would fit with Atlanta, but age wise he doesn't. He's 31, 32 already, so like, you know,
he'll be 33 next year.
Yeah, so you know, he'd be a great piece for them, and he would help them win, but it's not like he's going to help their long term future significantly. So I don't know that they would necessarily go after him, where, you know, a Miami or a Golden State, it makes a lot more sense. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know where he's even looking at this point, but I would venture to guess it's going to be a sign and trade to some extent. But to your point, I mean, teams that accept a player in a sign and trade can't go over the apron, which will be, I think it's like 138. I had it written out somewhere. I think it's like 138.9 million or something like that. It's whatever it was this year. So the Warriors, you know, already are well over that point, which will complicate sign and trade matters for them. So yes, I think, you know, beyond the two LA teams, Portland, Denver, I guess, is another one. Could be a potential sign and trade.
They should be one, because I know that, you know, listeners to this podcast, the regular listeners that is, are getting fed up with me, you know, complaining about this, but they lost that trade to Minnesota. They gave up a ton of talent and they are actually trying to win a championship. That was one of those deals that I know CJ, a friend of the podcast, CJ McBride, still loves it, but I am not a fan. I still think they lost too much talent to be up there on the regular, at least. I know they had a hell of a run this year. They need more. They need one final talent injection. If that comes via sign and trade, by all means.
Yeah. And Indiana, I guess, could be one. If there were, you know, it would probably be in conjunction with an Oladipo trade.
Right.
But that could at least be a pot, or maybe a Miles, you know, if they're getting Gallinari or Bertans, maybe they're trading out Miles Turner in a three-team deal. Like, the overall point is teams are going to, you know, there haven't been a single trade since February. Teams have had 9 months to work these things out. I think it is safe. We don't know exactly when the trade restriction will be lifted, but it sounds like it will be lifted before the draft. So, you know, probably next Sunday or Monday. And at that point, I think it is fair to expect a flurry of, if not moves right away, at least some rumors that, You know, like, things could get absolutely wild next week. Like, the NBA may be unrecognizable a week from Sunday.
We'll have two teams, right, that just, like, been in constant dialogue, and they're suddenly realizing that both of them have, you know, that next-door syndrome of, oh, your lawn looks a little bit greener than ours, and then they end up flipping rosters entirely.
Yeah.
That would be fantastic. Like, the Magic and the Spurs, like, they're pretty close. Like, they just flip it around. Like, the entire roster, like, are we doing this? Yeah, we're doing this. Let's just finish 2020 off with a bang, and they flip rosters. Come on, that would be fantastic. I want that to happen once in the NBA. I want two teams just once to flip rosters. That would be fantastic.
I'm glad you brought up the Magic, because this is one of the last things I thought about when this news came out. You know, we've been angling to get Aaron Gordon traded for years now.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's necessarily likely, since Jonathan Isaac is supposed to miss the entire 2020-21 season. But players on that type of contract, where it decreases instead of increases, especially given the uncertainty with the cap over the next few years,
right,
those guys are going to be worth more than their contract would indicate. Like, right. He is at 18.1 this year, goes down to 16.4 next year.
Yeah,
that's only going to boost his trade value. Like, Orlando was extremely smart the way they structured that deal, and I believe, if memory serves me right, Harrison Barnes has a similar structure.
That's correct. I just want to add something to Gordon on that front, because at one point you were not able to make it to the podcast, so I had Sean Devaney on, our colleague over at Forbes, and he told me on the podcast that this was actually done in large part because of Gordon's team. You know, Gordon's agent and him wanted to actually make himself an attractive trade piece. In the event that if it didn't work out with Orlando long term, he thus would be easier to trade, and it would be easier to facilitate a trade, which I found very, very interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah, and what I find even more interesting is that he hasn't gotten moved, because, as I would argue, the longer you go into that contract, the less attractive it becomes, even though it's declining, because, you know, then you're not reaping the benefits long term.
Right. Right. I mean, you know, after, you know, he's going to be a free agent in 2022, and he's probably going to make as much, if not more, money, because, you know, knock on wood, the world will be back to normal by then. And,
right,
you know, that's when, you know, we're talking about minimum of 3, maximum of 10% cap rise every year. That's when we could be on the higher end of the cap jumping. So, yeah, he could be looking at a somewhat substantial raise from that 16.4 million. You're totally right on there. But I think it would not surprise me if teams either, you know, are going after players on decreasing contracts like that, or again, go back to Atlanta or Charlotte, Detroit, New York. If any teams sign free agents this offseason, they should structure their contract like that, with,
right,
the biggest hit up front, and then decrease it moving forward, because that's only going to increase their trade value, especially given the financial uncertainty moving forward.
Yeah. So, I'm actually glad you brought up financial uncertainty moving forward, because I sort of have an idea, which I just wanted to bounce it off you. This might be one of the dumbest ideas ever, or it might actually be it might be the smartest idea ever in NBA salary relation. But basically, let's say that the global pandemic that we are currently suffering through is not going to be resolved quickly, even after the arrival of a virus. Let's say something mutates, it spreads again. This is going to be like a 10-year thing, right? And with that comes a lot of uncertainty. Well, would it behoove the NBA and the NBA Players Association to actually say, okay, because of these severe, weirdly circumstances, right, we are basically going to say that we are putting a cap, like, let's say 2025, from here on out, no contract is allowed to exceed the year 2025. And after that, when that summer hits, essentially everyone is a free agent, although you can maybe make some sort of negotiations that you are allowed to retain certain bird rights or whatever. You can make some exemptions. But the point is, afterwards, mm-hmm. the NBA switches over to what we've been talking about a little bit, which is just a completely percentage compensation. So instead of...
Oh.
Yeah, so instead of having the set salaries, it becomes a fluid situation where... You know, instead of a guy getting the $20 million, you know, you're signing for a percentage of the cap, so your salary can fluctuate and go up and down however mm-hmm. it wants to over the coming years. Because then you take into account the jumping economics of and consequences of the pandemic. Am I completely crazy for thinking in that route?
No, I don't think so. I mean, knock on wood, that will not be the reality,
right? Of course,
Like, let's first start there. Hopefully things yes. will be back to normal yes. by 2022 at the latest.
Right.
But
this was not going to sick fantasy on my behalf.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the problem is you might have the Players Association will have to agree to any change
of course,
that
yes.
large. And that might be a tough sell for them. You know, if especially in that worst case doomsday scenario of like revenues are just still going to stay flat or decline for the next X number of years, so right. your salary might decline. Like it was clear that the escrow this year was a sticking point, because they agreed to spread it out over. They say if the player compensation exceeds their share in any season. The reductions beyond the standard 10% escrow are spread across that season and potentially the next two seasons, subject to a maximum salary reduction in any season of 20%. So, you know, again, if revenues fall 40% this year, then players are going to exceed their share of revenue.
Right.
So you'll deduct 20% this year, and then you'll have to deduct 20% next year, in theory, to at least to just get right from this year. So... Yeah. You know, I think players probably like the fixed salary structure more than the percentage-based one, but would it be crazy for a general manager to try to float such a system? Like, I wonder if they're allowed to now, and the only thing preventing them is an agent saying, no, we just want
right
fixed terms.
Right. Again, I totally get it from the player's perspective. This would be... You know, severe circumstances the league might not even return. Like financially, it might be in ruins. This is the only way we can actually have a product in which mm-hmm. under which circumstances you will still earn literally millions of dollars to play basketball for a living every single season. But I'm sensing that every time we talk finances. That's the one thing I go to. I think a percentage-based compensation package just makes so much sense in uncertain times. Of course, the challenge here being you can't predict uncertain times.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, no, I think it's an idea worth exploring, and it wouldn't shock me. Like, again, God forbid we get to that type of a system where... You know, we know that things are going to be bad for the next few years. Like, it wouldn't shock me if they're willing to revisit those types of talks. Because, again, like, this thing a year ago would have been unfathomable, right? Anything that we're discussing right now, free agency in November, the draft in November, a bubble where you stage the playoffs with no fans and people are getting tested every day for a disease that we didn't even know existed. Like, none of this existed a year ago. So
We are laughing. Yes.
But you know, like it gives me confidence that the NBA and NBPA were able to yes. navigate these circumstances, and you know, knock on wood, there wasn't a protracted threat of a lockout. Like they briefly floated that as a possibility, and it was like, okay, we'll agree on the December 22nd date. Good point.
Yeah.
And we're good.
Really, every NBA fan should track down the address of the NBPA and send them flowers, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would be great.
That Michelle Roberts and Adam Silver have done tremendous work this yes. year to to keep the season on track and to, you know, to get this next season up and coming. It, you know, Mark Stein of the New York Times, to his credit, his normal Tuesday newsletter went out right before we started recording, and he brought up a very fair point that, like, for all of the concern that we expressed about the, you know, ahead of the bubble, the safety concerns ahead of the bubble, this upcoming season, there are far more logistical concerns. I mean, players are going to be playing in market, maybe traveling like normal. You know, they're going to try to reduce travel to some extent, I'm sure. We're still awaiting details on that front. They're still awaiting just the medical protocol in general. But, you know, there is uncontrolled COVID spread right now in the United States, like upward of 120,000 cases a day. It's only going to get worse with the holidays coming up. And these players are playing in market. So, you know, both sides have a tremendous challenge on their hands in the coming months. And, you know, I'm curious to see how they manage it. But given the way that everything has unfolded so far this year, I have confidence that they'll do it to the best of their abilities and, like, probably do it better than MLB, which let a effing player on the field with COVID celebrate a World Series title.
Yeah. Yeah, that was embarrassing. But I mean we've been ringing that bell for months, if not over a year now, that the relationship between the NBA and the NBPA, well, yes, sometimes they will go into scare tactics, but it is profoundly positive compared to the Stern era. And I mean, look, I'm at that point where I think it could be fun come February 14th to basically make Adam Silver and Michelle Roberts, like, heart-shaped chocolate boxes, right? Because it's perfect. Like, institutions, they have a genuine affection for one another. They want, like, the league wants to take care of their players. The players' union also wants what's best for the league while also taking care of their own interests. I think they found a symmetry that is just very, very effective. So my faith in that combination is very, very stable.
Yes, I agree with that. Well, Mort, I think that's a good place for us to wrap up. So we hope you're doing well out there. Hope you're staying safe. Get ready for a wild 2 weeks. We are going to be recording a lot next week, I think, with, you know, again, we don't know when the trade moratorium ends, but probably Sunday or Monday, draft on Wednesday, free agency, teams can start negotiating, quote-unquote, start negotiating at 6 p.m. Friday.
Yeah.
So get ready to listen to us a lot. We're going to have some fun.
Yeah. And also, I promise everyone out there listening in, this was the last almost fully financial episode. I am going to kick Brian's ass if he does it one more time. Don't worry. We will discuss actual players and teams and basketball. That will be a staple. Don't worry.
Yes. But, I mean, look, this stuff might be boring, but, like, it's going to shape a lot of what happens over the next 2 weeks.
Of course. I'm not debating that it's not important. I'm just saying that we should be able to just throw in a little team and out. You know what? I'm just going to do it because there's not a deadline on this one. I actually wanted to bring up the Charlotte Hornets, so I'm going to do it. We're going to finish on the Hornets. Then we have some basketball talk to wrap up this program with, okay? So the rumor going around is, of course, that they want to trade up to number one and take James Wiseman because they are in love with Wiseman. And they look at him as the guy who will round out that rotation, you know, starting Devontae at the one, Rozier at the two. You'll have Miles Bridges, you have PJ Washington, and then presumably Wiseman in the middle. That will round out the whole lineup. However, the cost of trading up for 3-1 is presumably one of those current starters, in which case, you know what I would do? I wouldn't do it. I would instead just take Onyeka Okongwu and just say, you know what? I'm not giving up that core. I am at a stage, in a rebuild where as an NBA organization, we as an NBA organization can't afford to give up starting caliber prospects or starting caliber talent just to move up two slots in an NBA draft that is uncertain, especially this one. Like, that is just a non-starter. I would basically say to the Charlotte Hornets, who are obviously listening in right now, don't make that trade. Gamble on the fact that the Minnesota Timberwolves already have Karl-Anthony Towns. Call their bluff. There's no way in hell they're going to take James Wiseman. That is just imagine if that happens. They would be the laughingstock. It won't happen.
The problem is whether the Warriors would take him at two, right?
That's the thing. If they do, you could say, okay, we still have Onyeka, but if you trade up for 3-2, and that's the thing, you would have to gauge the interest level of the Golden State Warriors. But like then that would presumably still be cheaper. If the Warriors aren't necessarily as in love with Wiseman, you know, they're just open to taking him, that cost would be less. But again, I wouldn't sacrifice long-term flexibility. Overall, I'm basically saying, I understand you want your guy, but don't sacrifice additional assets in this particular draft to move up when you are so hungry for talent. It would be a step back. That you, the only chance you would have to win this is if Wiseman becomes a flat-out stud. And the thing about that is, in this draft, where there is so much uncertainty surrounding every single prospect, even at the very top of the draft, it's not worth it. You've got to play it safe. And yes, it might blow up in your face, but that's the calculated risk.
Well, I mean, I guess for Charlotte, the question is, what is the cost to trade up? Like, if it's just Malik Monk and three for number one, you probably do that, right?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. But is he not a free agent? Does he have 1 year left?
I think he's got one more year left.
I thought he was a fourth-year guy. You're right. He's like a three-year guy, right?
Yeah, 2017.
Oh, God, he's been so anonymous, that's why. Yeah, that I do. But like, if it's Miles Bridges, like, hell no.
Like, PJ Washington?
No. PJ Washington, I think, is basically the prototypical big forward now, right? A guy who essentially can play both forward spots, like sort of a Harrison Barnes, Tobias Harris type of player who is going to be incredibly valuable as the league swings down to, you know, smaller forwards at the big spot. I mean, Miles Bridges and PJ Washington, I think, are two staples there. And, you know, okay, you could argue Devontae Graham is already 25 and he's going to be a free agent in 2021. He needs, you know, to be re-signed. Is he the starting caliber of, you know, point guard moving forward? I would venture that you need at least, you owe it to him, you owe it to yourself to at least test him out one more year. Now, the guy I would be open to if it came down to it is Terry Rozier. But even then, I mean, he went from being, you know, a joke of a contract last summer, and he had a legitimately good year.
40% from the field, baby.
40% or Terry Rozier. There we go, right? But, I mean, wouldn't you feel, if you were a Hornets fan, wouldn't you feel that that was a very risky play, giving up one of your starters?
Well, especially, I mean, we talked with Jonathan Wasserman in a Bleacher Report last episode, and he's saying he has Wiseman at, like, you know, 7-10 on his board. It's not like Wiseman is the home run, slam dunk, obvious number one pick like Zion was, or like Luka should have been, you know?
Yeah.
I think you said it in that episode. This is like the 2013 draft with Anthony Bennett's the out of nowhere number one pick. Like, there just isn't a clear cut number one.
Oh, that was so, Wuss, actually, just to give credit the right way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But it's a good comparison. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, Wuss is one of, I'm sure he's not the only person who has Okonkwo above Wiseman on his board. So
Ricky O'Donnell is also fairly low on Wiseman as well. Yeah.
And again, you know, we've hammered this point home a lot in the last few months, but like, just given the declining value of centers in general, you better be sure James Wiseman is a transcendent unicorn center. Because if not, you know, that's a big asset to be spending. Even if you stay put at number three, it's a big asset to be spending. If you move up, like, you better be damn sure this guy is going to be, you know, number one on a championship team good someday.
Yeah. Totally agree. And if the situation was there where the Hornets could actually even trade down and pick Okongwu, where they even pick up an asset, that would be the home run play for me.
Right.
I would much rather do that.
Yeah, like if one of Edwards or, let's say, Edwards and Wiseman go 1 and 2.
Right.
You have LaMelo Ball there at three. Teams want to trade up.
Yes.
You know Okongwu is going to slide down to, you know,
6, 7, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's where, yeah. I like that play.
Right? Okay, see, we ended up some basketball talk.
There we go. Well, we could do a whole episode maybe later this week or over early next week on just, you know, what the latest draft buzz is and whether it actually makes sense or not.
Yeah, baby. Sounds good.
Because I've seen plenty of, you know, plenty of rumors flying around these last few days, and I'm sure we're only going to get more of it as we get closer to the draft. So, again, everyone, buckle up. I don't think anyone had a sense of how wild this next week or two is going to be, but hope you didn't have any plans between now and Thanksgiving because the NBA is taking over November.
I love it. I'm down for it.
Me too. Well, in the meantime, please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And you, if you listened in, we were also recording live today on the Locker Room app. So download the Locker Room app. It is on iOS. You can listen live to when we record podcasts and get a sneak peek by a few hours of our latest episodes. Until next time, I'm Brian Zaporik, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You too, Brian. Take care, man, and don't die.
You too.